potential energy. When you also include Maxwell fields, or on a quarter here. So if you vary A here, you'll get the Maxwell equation. But presumably, if you have a charged particle anyway, you know, there's some interaction. Well, you know actually what it is. There's an energy with the scalar potential. And if the particle's moving, it turns out for electromagnetism there's a velocity-dependent potential that works. Right. So this Lorentz force law, what is it, QE plus V cross V. You can derive this from a potential, but that potential is going to depend on the velocity. In fact, the easiest way to write it is to actually put it in the velocity. So if you write V minus EA here, that'll actually give you the right magnetic coupling, plus or minus the charge times the scalar potential. So you write, if you do a Hamiltonian formulation of the Lorentz force law, you'll find that this is the conjugate momentum, actually. So this is called minimal coupling. It's the same thing you end up doing with the Dirac equation. But it's like a covariant time derivative of the position is what you're really getting here. And then you can add in the electric potential as a normal potential. So if you vary the vector potential here, you're also going to vary it here. And so this charged particle will provide the current for the Maxwell equation. Basically, the current is something like the charge times the velocity. Looks like the electric current for a single charged particle. And you'll get, if you vary, if you vary the path, you'll get the Lorentz force law out of this stuff. Now let me see, because this depends on the position. Right. So if you vary x of t, right, you're gonna vary phi. So you get partial of phi with respect to xi del xi. Right. From varying this term here, you'll have some velocity couplings because of the cross term. I'm pretty sure varying this will give you the Lorentz force law for that particle. But the point is, it's, you know, you've got a particle and you've got the field, and then some coupling between them. If you want to write the Lorentz force law relativistically, it's the time rate of change of, proper time rate of change of momentum is E over C U beta F beta alpha, give or take a sign. So this is the covariant form of the Lorentz force law. It, you know, if you look at alpha equals zero, it's energy conservation. If you look at alpha equals a spatial index I, you'll find the Lorentz force law here. Beelzebub, you probably need to take the field and work with the field equations to derive the Beelzebub from current or moving charges. So, you know, if you have some macroscopic system and analyze it macroscopically, in terms of the moving charges and what forces those charges put on other parts of the circuit or something. So you apply the field theory to a circuit, I think you'll get the Beelzebub law. It's quite general. You really need it to get some stuff, but get derivation of that. You know, it's usually just done in intros, an analogy to the Coulombs. It's got to do with the force between two moving charges. So you're probably still talking about this action, but you're looking at the velocity coupling between, you know, something moving over here in a magnetic field and something moving over there in a magnetic field. What is it? Usually that's used for circuitry and where you have currents. It doesn't have to be. You know, there's like a QV cross B way of writing it. You could probably derive that the oath of R by applying the Lorentz force law to some circuitry or some system of charges. I think it would have to follow from that. The Lorentz force law is more fundamental, and you can get it from an action. And it actually is minimally coupled, so you could actually treat this as a gauge theory. And as long as your time derivative, you know, the xdt, I think this is how it works. It would work. I have to work through it. You can take this to a covariant time derivative, where you include the vector potential in this as a connection. I think you could probably do it that way. It's a little more satisfying from a fundamental particle physics point of view, where you really have the U1 invariant. You know, you don't see the U1 invariant here because there's the charge is not coming from a complex conjugation the way it does in Dirac theory or Schrodinger theory. You've got these conjugate fields in the action, so you really have a U1 symmetry. You have a U1 symmetry, but nothing actually transforms under it here. The electric charge that you would put in is purely phenomenological. You just say, oh, suppose it's charged, and you stick in an E or a Q or something. Anyway, that's the way it was arrived. So you get Lorentz force law from this kind of thing. If you want more than you're right, that would totally be out of context, and we can't answer that. Okay. But anyway, you ready for... Yeah?
Just one more.
Sure.
This is a curious question. Can you make any general Lie group into a Lie group?
Make any...
general group into a Lie group.
Any general group.
Yeah, like a group that's all Lie group. Can you make that?
Oh, into a Lie group.
Yeah.
No, V2, the Boolean group. You know, it's only got two elements. I suppose that's a subgroup of, something. the extension is not more than what you're starting with. I mean, you know, there might be ways to embed, you know, most any discrete group into some Lie group, but I don't know that there's any principled relationship there. Lie groups are, simple Lie groups are completely classified. You know, we know what they all are. And they actually have to do with projective spaces constructed from normed division algebras. If you really wanted to know. Norm division algebras are the real complex numbers, quaternions and actonians. And corresponding to each of those types of number, you can build projective spaces. And corresponding to those projective spaces, you have these, you know, the unitary groups or the orthogonal groups. So for example, take the real, take n copies. Now take projective real n space, puts you onto an n-dimensional, n-1 dimensional sphere. the symmetry of that sphere is an orthogonal group. Right? Similarly, with complex, you can get unitary groups. With the quaternions, you can get the symplectic groups. And with the octonions, you can't really construct very many projective geometries with the octonions. They don't actually work that way. But you can construct a handful, and that gives you the exceptional group. So there's a real systematicity to how they arise. Okay. Good? Example?
Good about what?
So we can, I don't know. You feel good? let's do an example of, let's gauge something. Okay. So last time I wrote up were you all here for that? Nathan asked a really good question. Yeah, for a synopsis of the method. And so we filled the board with a synopsis of the method. Let's see. Neil might not have seen that, but it'll get online eventually. But we should implement the method. For another set of examples. Let's see. What should we do? All right. We did U1 with a translation group. I'm a little torn. We could do something like an SU2 gauge theory and get the Dweck interaction. And I could put that together with a four-dimensional translation group. So we've got this four-dimensional translation group, and we can just do internal symmetries. It's not terribly satisfying to just have the translational symmetries. So we could do gravity first and get general relativity. So you see how to construct the actual background space-time. And then we can put these various internal symmetries on it. Do you have any feeling what you'd like to see? We can go at it either way.
Is it like a direct action sort of for general relativity and for T2? Is it similar? You know, it's like the action that we had for E and for the, you know?
Let's see, a direct sort of action. Let me understand the question.
It's like linear in D, I believe, you know, with mass from in there.
The Dirac action or the Klein-Gordon action, which is a relativistic Schrodinger, basically. Let's see. Yeah, maybe we should talk about particle actions a little bit. You know, pretty much all of this stuff starts from the Dirac action. Right? All of the fundamental particles of matter, the quarks and the leptons, are Dirac particles. So, typically, the Dirac action is your starting point, or perhaps a collection of Dirac actions for several different particles. And you look at the symmetry of the Dirac action and gauge that symmetry. And that then gives you forces between those particles. You can get general relativity from the Poincaré transformations of the Dirac action. You know, you can actually motivate all of the forces between the combinations of Dirac
action.
Yeah, the way the symmetry comes in is a little different. Suppose we have might use the I today before X. If I do that action is unchanged by a Lorentz transformation or a translation, by a Poincaré transformation. So I could change this to I could gauge that Poincaré symmetry by looking at local form for a transformation as well. What I would end up doing is taking a quotient by the Lorentz group. I'd end up with a four-dimensional manifold from the translations, which gives the base manifold. And then local Lorentz transformations would give me general relativity, all right, or applying the procedure would give me general relativity. The way this couples is not just through a covariant derivative here, but you'd need the square root of g here as well. You need to change that volume form to get the right coupling. But that's the only way it really differs from the, you know, changing to a covariant derivative. But you also need that root g for general coordinate or local Lorentz invariant. Local Lorentz, local Lorentz. I'm trying to think whether that root g is always going to be 1. For a Lorentz transformation, it is. I have to think what happens to that in that case, if you treat it that way. For other symmetries, you know, if you want FU2, all right, U1, the invariant here is immediate. You have a phase, the opposite phase here, and you gauge that, you get electromagnetism. But if you take several particles that all satisfy a Dirac action. So, for example, the electron and the neutrino. All right, so A runs from 1 to 2. Or the up and down quark. It's actually the same FU2 symmetry. You can do FU2 rotations that actually mix the up and the down quarks. So we could look at those symmetries. Again, I'm torn which we want to do first, whether you want to construct space-time and see where gravity comes in, or these internal symmetries are simpler, U1, FU2, FU3. And there, the... Now, taking this group quotient is not quite so important because all we're really going to construct is flat space. It's only when you get gravity that you use this quotient to construct an interesting manifold. Maybe we should do the internal symmetries first. They're just simpler. So let's try this. Okay, so suppose we've got A equals, let's take it a step at a time. That'll let me show you the same thing over again. the procedure is the same. You know, I've written sum from 1 to 2. The procedure is the same for FUN as it is for FU2. You don't do anything different. You've just got more generators and... but the procedure is exactly the same. The general structure of the theory looks the same. You just let the range of the indices be greater. But let's suppose for A equals 1 and 2, so psi A is really a pair of spinner fields. So each of these is a four-component Dirac spinner.
So there are 8 components total?
So there are 8 components in one of these. This one is called the electron spinner, and this one the neutrino spinner, or words to that effect. So what we're really writing here is the sum of 2 Dirac actions, one of which is for the electron, one of which is for the neutrino. There's a minor difficulty. The difficulty is the mass. The electron and the neutrino don't have equal masses. So you can't actually rotate between these exactly. If you're working at high energy, the masses are negligible compared to the energy, and so you can just drop them. And for a lot of calculations, you actually do that. Let's see. Is there some way... you can fix that by making a mass matrix. So you replace M by some MAB, and so this term is psi bar A. Of these fields. Now that matrix transforms by similarity transformation. So under SU2, a term like this could be invariant, and you can still give the two particles different masses. And then depending on the basis, this M might or might not be diagonal. So the you can actually mix up the mass of the electron and the neutrino. So if you decide you don't want all your electrons to have 511 keV masses, then you can rotate some of that into the neutrino field. So this is the way we can handle it. Then what you always do is you choose a gauge where that's diagonal, and then you're working in energy eigenstates. Where particles have definite masses, those are energy eigenstates. So we have a global SU2 symmetry. Now, how do we write an element of SU2?
SU2 by 2, e to the I over 2.
Some angle, you know, the I pi over 2, and that, yeah. Minus pi over 2 sigma, that's a good way to think of what the generators are. Because then the commutation relations of these, you get real structure constants. Gij, gj, you're going to have minus pi over 2 squared, commutator of sigma I with sigma j. This gives minus quarter, plus a quarter, minus a quarter. And then this commutator is 2i upon ijk sigma k, and then minus I over 2 sigma k is gk. So we end up with epsilon ijk gk. Those are real, so that's the proper form of the structure constant. You can just use the Pauli matrices, people do all the time. Since the Pauli matrices are Hermitian, they're quantum observables, and so you frequently will see the choice made that the generators are the Hermitian form of the generators. But that's a general element of SU2. We've got two parameters, phi, and then the unit vector n has 2 degrees of freedom, so we've got three real numbers to specify what the group element is. Let's call this g at phi and hat, three real numbers to specify which group element we're talking about. But this then acts on this pair of spinners. So our electron prime prime and our neutrino prime are an SU2 rotation of what they were before. And if you choose a global values of the angle and the unit vector, so you choose one element of SU2 and apply that to the electron neutrino pair the same way at every point in space-time, then it leaves that action invariant. Let's put the matrix in here. So if we start with F, so let's look at the global SU2. We want to write the action as the sum on A and B integral phi bar A Kronecker AB D slash minus MAB phi B. And then if we replace phi by phi prime given by an element of a constant element of SU2. Well, this is a weird thing to do. We're mixing up the electron and the neutrino spinner. Yeah.
Good question. SU2 is a 2x2 matrix, right?
Right.
But we have an eight component spinning, is that right?
Yeah. Think of this as if you want all eight components divided into 4x4, and then you've got the identity. It's the identity on this part. It's the identity on this part. It's just mixing up the two pieces. This only sees the two fields. It's going to do the same thing to all components of the electron spinner. So it's really only going to multiply that electron spinner. But yeah, let's work this out, and I'll write out exactly what it is. I'll do it here. So this is some matrix. Let's call this A D, some on D. So what's that really mean? As a 2x2 matrix, we know that we can write this as the identity times the cosine phi over 2 minus I n hat dot the sigma sine phi over 2. So that's our matrix phi B. So, all right, what does this really mean? A and B run from 1 to 2. So the new electron field is going to be the A equals 1 component of all this. Well, what does this look like? This matrix is this. We've got a cosine phi over 2 minus I and Z sine phi over 2. Down here, we're going to have minus I nx plus I ny times sine phi over 2. Here we have minus I nx minus I ny sine phi over 2. And here we have finally, cosine phi over 2, then it'll be plus I and the sine pi over 2 pi e pi nu. All four components of pi e come along for the ride. So they all get the same factor. So pi e prime, all right, yes, this is alpha e, beta e, gamma e, delta e. It's some four component thing, prime. But the SU2 transformation doesn't mix those. So it keeps the same spinner field in that direction.
So it's equally 8 by 8 or 3 and 2 by 2?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, I just said that. okay, so
is that a negative in the argument on that?
Where?
The lower right element of.
There?
Yeah.
No, because sigma z has a minus sign in that component. Sigma z is plus 1, minus 1. So there's a sigma z on this part. Those two have opposite signs.
Okay, but what about in the argument of sign? That's a negative?
Oh, that's a dot of the I.
Oh, okay.
There.
That would have been interesting.
You're taking me very literally today, as if what I was writing was true. Sorry. Okay, so what we get is phi e cos phi over 2 minus I n v sine phi over 2 minus I phi nu and x minus I and y sine phi over 2. And similarly here, phi minus I by E and X plus I and Y sine pi over 2 plus phi nu quantity plus pi over 2 plus I and Z and pi over 2 close friend. Now, okay, it's precisely because we're concealing the four-spinner character of each of these, so you still have a little two-component thing where the top is some four-spinner, the bottom is some four-spinner. So it's clear that you cannot totally change the electron and neutrino fields into one another by such a simple transformation. Right? You're getting an overall multiple of them, but you're not totally interchanging the whole spinner fields. You can't. There aren't enough transformations here to do that.
Question, Joe? The second term?
Yeah.
Are we still looking... Is that the whole of it, or... are we still looking at the second term on the bottom line? Is that still psi e and psi nu?
Right. These are the old
not that. To the left.
Oh.
That.
By E prime. By new prime.
Okay. See, I don't trust myself to make your corrections, honestly.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, really, this is some big, you know, each of these is
okay, each of those breaks up into four.
Beta E prime, gamma E prime, delta E prime. And then down here, you've got an alpha nu prime, beta nu prime, gamma nu prime, delta nu prime. So you're batting 1,000, Joe. First question, your sense of it was right on each time.
It's actually, you should probably put my identity right next to each of these elements because it's actually
there are identities all over the place here. Let's see. If you know, this thing, you know, what that really looks like is, an identity times an element of SU2 direct product. Okay. Okay, so if you want to think of it as an 8x8 thing, yeah, it's a direct product of two matrices, an SU2 matrix and a four-dimensional complex transformation, and that four-dimensional complex transformation is not doing anything. So, yeah, that's right, that's right. Are there other questions? Yeah, if you put in indices for everything in sight, you have more indices than fields. there are a lot of things going on here. Not too bad just at the moment. There are only three different kinds of index in that action at this point. There'd be three kinds of... So, for example, if you look at that first term, phi a bar... We've written the delta A B B slash of phi B, but this B slash has a space time index on it, and then the gamma matrix has some sort of an IJ acting on it, so that had better sum on the four components here. And then you have a derivative alpha of psi bj. There it is with all the indices. Right? So it's a product. You've got two here and four here, so there are really eight components to that thing. Sorry, I interrupted. What? Okay. So, yeah, that's what happens if you break it all out.
It seems like indices for indices, capital A's and B's.
we could. It's good practice to do this, once in a while to remind yourself, oh, okay, there are lots of different things going on here, and you have to work with this a little bit to really feel comfortable suppressing half of the indices and just working with the ones that are relevant. But there are three spaces here. All right, the spinner space, the SU2 space, and space-time. They don't know about each other. They don't care about each other. Whatever you do with space-time indices, it's just going to ignore the other stuff. Neil, you have a question?
Yeah, and it's just an algebra thing.
Yeah.
So we're taking our exponential and converting it into the trig functions there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's just an identity. You expand that and it becomes that.
Right. Help me. Okay. For some reason, I'm not seeing why the n hat sigma only appears on the sign.
Write the Taylor series for the exponential. You're going to get powers of this. If you square n hat dot sigma, it squares to 1.
Okay.
Alright.
So that's
all right, you have ni sigma I
times
nj sigma j,
yeah.
And that's an ni nj, then Kronecker ij plus I epsilon ij k sigma k.
Right.
And since this is symmetric, this term gives 0. It'd be n cross n. So that drops out, you just get... the magnitude of this unit vector n squared is a unit vector, so it's 1. So the even terms of this series, which give a cosine,
right,
all multiply just the identity.
Since they square, it all just goes to the identity.
And then the odd powers, which give a sign, all have one extra guy.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. I got it. Good, thanks.
Sure. Okay. So... we could do an example. I mean, just to show how simple this transformation really is. So suppose n hat is just a unit vector in the z direction, 0, 0, 1. Now, in that case, this is just a phase transformation, right? So psi e prime and psi nu prime are just, okay... then n x and n y are 0, so this is diagonal. Of course, I've chosen a very simple case here. But you have cos phi over 2 minus I sine phi over 2 is just e to the minus I phi over 2 times phi e. And then here you get easily I-Fi plus I-Fi over 2 by new. So you haven't even mixed the fields if N is in the Z direction. You've just changed the relative phases of those two. Well, that's boring, but yeah, so this can actually mix some of the neutrino and some of the electron fields. But it's not mixing them so much that the two particles have really lost their separate identities entirely. It's fair enough to think of them as two parts of the same object in the same way that we can think of the electric and magnetic fields as two parts of the same Maxwell field tensor. Psi E and Psi nu are two parts of the same two-component object. But we can still tell the difference between electric and magnetic fields. The electric field is always the space-time cross term in the Maxwell field tensor, and that has some different properties than the space-space parts of that Maxwell field tensor. So what we want to do is gauge this symmetry.
Before you go on, can you repeat what this on the right means? I must have been.
Which part? There are three different notes here.
Well, let's start with the first note.
Okay, I'm expanding the indices in this expression. Remember, each of these is a four-component Dirac spinner. All right, I and J run 1, 2, 3, 4 over the four components of that complex four vector. Alpha is a space-time index, runs 0, 1, 2, 3. Well, this derivative, there's a derivative in here that's a space-time derivative. So there's actually a sum over the four space-time coordinates. Time in the three spatial ones. A and B run just 1 to 2 over electrons and neutrinos. Electron field, neutrino field. So I'm just breaking out in uncomfortable detail the true complexity of what we're really talking about here. We're using a lot of shorthand.
Okay.
So that's what this is about. In this one,
I got that.
Okay, you got that. And then here, I'm taking a particular example of this transformation where n hat is in the z direction. And in that case, it turns into just a simple phase transformation of the two fields. Of course, that's the simplest case I could have chosen, but the mixing does not extend into mixing the different components of that spinner or the different components of that spinner. So it's only certain combinations we're getting here.
Isn't a direction in any particular direction in space?
It's not a spatial direction. Yeah. It's not in the physical it's not a space-time direction. Okay? These are three independent spaces don't know about one another.
Right.
Until you get to supersymmetry. And they learn a little bit about one another. But, two supersymmetry transformations give a translation. So, actually, a transformation that mixes different spin fields can interact non-trivially with the Poincaré group. But that's one of nature's deeper mysteries, which we won't get to until later.
Certainly.
Let's not do that today.
What do we call the space at this vector? What is it in this n hat?
We call that, let's see. There's a name for that. Let's see. Family generation, the up and down space required. There's a name for that direction. I can't think what it is. Yeah, nothing. It's. Oh, now wait. Let's see. Is that isospin? Yeah, that's ISIS in Spain.
Yeah,
because, okay, you know, ISIS Spin was introduced in the 60s as a symmetry, an approximate symmetry between neutrons and protons. You know, so you wanted to think of the proton as a spin-up something, and the neutron as a spin-down something. You know, they're about the same mass. One's charged, one's not. And, well, it turns out that, in fact, is what happens. It's the up-and-down quark that rotate under this very SU2. So this is ISIS spin space. Probably the best you can do. It's an older term for the weak symmetry. But it's an abstract space. It's, okay, you know, it's not one that you're going to go jogging in. And of course, we do have many pairs like the electron neutrino, right? All of the fundamental particles of matter come with, they come with a weak force identity of some sort. I mean, they might be a scalar, or they might be a little two-component vector, or they could be some higher rank tensor. Well, in fact, almost everything is either a scalar or a vector, except for the gauge fields, which come as a tensor. The gauge fields are an SU2 matrix, right? They're the local group elements. They're Lie algebra valued one forms. They live in the Lie algebra. So those are matrices. But the up and down quarks, the charmed and strange quarks, the top and bottom quark, the electron and electron neutrino, the muon neutrino, the tau and tau neutrino. Each of those six pairs is transformed within itself under SU2 weak, under the weak interaction. They all enter symmetrically like this. So lots of these pairs. Well, okay, so let's gauge it. How do we gauge it? We apply our method. Yeah, we can cut right to the chase, make it a capital D. We can add a field strength. But let's go through the whole construction. Let's go back and do the formal stuff with the groups just to see. I'll put in the translation groups like we did with U1, just so that we're constructing space-time at the same time. We're not going to do anything, you know. We're not going to curve that part yet, but we could.
So this is just going to be like the translations cross SU2?
Translations cross SU2.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, we'll keep the space-time stuff simple until we've had a chance to see a mill field or two, and then we can throw in gravity. So, local SU2 weak. And, you know, there are other SU2s in the world. SU2 is a great rotation group. It's a little part of the Lorentz group. This is SU2 weak. You got to remember which space you're in. So, that's how I'm working. Okay, so how do we do this? We have a symmetry group, and we'll take it to be SU2 cross 4 translation, and our subgroup is going to be just SU2, and so our group quotient is a four-dimensional manifold and has SU2 symmetry. So what we're talking about is four-dimensional space-time. At each point, we have copies of SU2. So an SU2 5 bundle over space-time. So altogether, this is some eight-dimensional manifold. Eight dimensions, three for the group manifold of SU2, four dimensions for the translation. And question?
Yeah, is the translation group a big group as well? Or?
Yeah, it's an abelian Lie group.
Oh, okay.
Lots of normal subgroups. It's not a simple group. It's not one that anybody really uses for real physical models. Because what we really put here is the Poincaré group, which includes space-time translations and Lorentz transformations, and that's non-abelian. The translation still can use. Or if you want to go further, you take the conformal group, and then the whole group is non-abelian. It is, in fact, a simple group that contains the Poincaré group. It's the smallest simple group containing the Poincaré group.
Mm-hmm.
That works nicely here. And I might in fact already include that too, depending on how you gauge it. It might contain a couple of these.
Is this non-relativistic?
Is what?
Non-relativistic?
No, it can be relativistic. Yeah, T4. What manifold is space time?
Well, it's R4. Right.
It's got an indefinite metric on it, but R4 is fine for the manifold itself. And since we're not curving it or anything that would actually be interesting, R4 is just fine. We'd like to. So this will be dealing with flat space time. Let's see. So what do we need to say about this? We want the Lie algebra. And, the elements are things like translation by some constant A alpha, and then down here we have elements of SU2, we could call those H. So H is an element of SU2, it's just a direct product. It's all zeros off here. G A alpha is an element of our four translations, and we found we could write that as a five-dimensional identity matrix with A0, A1, A2, A3 sitting over there, acting on what vector space? Okay, we've got a five-dimensional matrix here, we've got a two-dimensional matrix here. What this acts on is X alpha and 1, and then down here, psi electron, psi neutrino. So those are the objects that this group acts on. Was there a question?
I was just saying that.
No. Oh, okay. And you know, clearly the H is going to map psi E and psi nu and not know anything about the X, and the G is going to translate the X and not know anything about the psi E and psi nu, and it zeroes off diagonal. Now, if you wanted to build some unified theory and make some new predictions, you would say, oh, what if these weren't zero off here? What if they were something else? And those would introduce some new fields that would turn electrons into translations or something very weird. So, you know, this is not what we expected. This is how you build a unified thing, is you allow those off diagonal bits to be non-zero and see what happens.
Where did the 1 come from?
In order to do a translation as a matrix, you want to let you put in one extra dimension and it helps. So if I let this act on x0, x1, x2, x3, and 1, the result, all right, that 1 picks up the A when you multiply. So in the first place, you get x0 plus a0, x1 plus a1. Each time this 1 is hitting that last column and adding the translation to the x, x3 plus a3. And then the last column, you just pick up a 1 again. So the 1 isn't actually
just doing much. It's just
keeping things together. Yeah, you could. What would happen if you stuck a number in there? It would give a delimitation of the translation or something. Not the way to do it. Okay, so there are our group elements. This is not the Lie algebra. This is the group elements here. And so we find the generators.
How is that normally written? The group elements, or
so the group elements are 7x7 matrices, right? With three real parameters. Seven real parameters. Seven.
It's kind of funny. It looks like a, what should we call that? Like a real matrix, like a complex matrix over here at the bottom.
This is a complex thing, that's a real thing. It's fine.
Is that a big T or is that a small T?
Let's see, which one? Big G is the whole group. So this is an element of big G.
All right.
Acting on some vector representation.
We call it little G because group elements.
We could call this. Let me use a double G for a generic element here, and it's acting on some sort of vector. So, we could call this some abstract vector V in some seven-dimensional vector space, and that gives us a linear representation of the group. So the generators for T4, take the parameters infinitesimal. So our element G A alpha can, or at small parameter epsilon, can be written as the identity plus epsilon alpha. Generator G alpha, where G alpha is pretty much zero everywhere except one position. Zero. So it's in the last column. So this would be G zero, G one, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, and so on. Then for the SU2 part. The generators, let's call them capital H's, say. HI is minus, let's call these generators tau. Minus I over 2 sigma I are the generators. And then for the Lie algebra, think of each of these as really being a 7x7 matrix. So we get 0 down here, everywhere, and 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0 everywhere else. There's just a 1 sitting up there in that top part. These are zeros everywhere except down here. So here we have minus I over 2 and a Pauli matrix, and zeros everywhere else for the generators. So those are the generators of the group. The Lie algebra is very simple. So almost everything in fact commutes.
Except for the bottom right corner.
Yeah, exactly. So the Lie algebra. We have the G's, there are 4 of those, G alpha, G beta, alpha beta equals 0, 1, 2, 3, those all commute. If I take a G alpha with a tau I, those all commute. If I take a tau I with a tau j, it's epsilon I j k, tau k. So that's for the algebra. Everybody with me? Any questions so far? So, Maurer Cartanic equations. Nathan, question?
Yeah, sorry.
No, fine.
I do not understand, where do you get the partition matrices? Where do you get those from?
The partition matrices, the...
Yeah. Do you just assume that the first five elements, five columns of G are just squishing?
Yeah, these are all zeros, right? Because the one gives the one... where did my G go? The one gives this part, plus... So, it's these four things that multiply the generators. So, if I put a 1 in here with epsilon 0, the identity plus that...
Okay, you're still looking to prove that. Okay.
So, a general one of these, if I take four matrices like this with some epsilon, then this is going to be... epsilon 0, epsilon 1, epsilon 2, epsilon 3. That's just a small part. But then here I'm indicating, well, there are two more components that I'm ignoring. Okay. So now we define the algebra value of one form.
How did you get the last line? Where did that come from?
Those are the commutation relations of SU2 with the particular choice of generators I've made. I defined tau I to be minus I over 2 times the Pauli matrix.
Okay.
And calculate tau I with tau j is I get minus I over 2 squared times the commutator of two Pauli matrices, which is, right, that is... minus 1/4, then I have 2i upon ijk sigma k, and I recognize I minus I over 2 sigma k as being a tau again. And everything else commutes. Then, we want some of the algebra value one form. Dual to the generators. So let's take some omega betas, one forms omega beta dual to the G's. There will be four of those. With the H's, with the tau's, those will give zero. And then dual to the tau I, we'll have some, what should I call these? Let's call them AI. Or AJ here. Delta JI. And the G's and the A's don't know about one another. So this defines the dual one form. And so the Maurer-Cartan equation... right here. We get D of the omega alphas. Will be minus 1/2 C Now, I need an index that runs over all 7 generators. So let capital Greek letters, et cetera, be zero, one, two, three, or one, two, three, where this is an alpha and that's one of our I's. So sigma and delta run over all the alphas and all the I's. So I'll have a sigma and a delta here, and then I need to get an alpha up there. So for example, a gauge field, let's call it omega, capital sigma is either an omega alpha or an AI. So I just need a generic symbol that includes all of them. Yeah, they're all going to be zero anyway, but let me try and write it. Right, so I'm looking for structure constants that give an alpha. Right, remember what these things look like. This is a C alpha beta and capital delta for, do we have a generic generator thing? Let's call it generic generator, like a double G delta. All right, so that runs over the A's and the G's, but those are all zeros. And here we have the C alpha I delta G delta. Well, those are all zero. The only thing that's not zero is, and let me put the K up. So we have a CIJK is just epsilon IJK. That's the only non-zero structure constant. Those are the only non-zero structure constants, the ones where all three are lowercase Latin. So these are zero. Then we look at D of the omega, or the AI, and it's minus a half. See, this sum runs over everything, but the only ones that are non-zero are the ones where these are also lowercase Latin. So we get an A, J wedge, A, K, with, in fact, an epsilon. So minus a half epsilon, J, K, I, A, J wedge, A, K. And that's dA. So the Maurer-Carton equations are d omega equals zero, and d AI is minus a half epsilon, J, K, I, A J wedge A K. Okay, what's the next step?
Then you gotta add up these, what do we call it? Two forms? Curvature?
Add curvature two forms. Yeah, that's right. So horizontal curvature two forms satisfying the Beyond given. So if we generalize, that'll give us the Carton equation.
Did you have to, what was it?
You want me to write something again?
I think it was on the first floor.
Why did the first term go to zero?
If you look over here what the structure constants are, right, these are ones that have a Greek index as the up index. What that means over from the Lie algebra is that the G's of Greek generators have to occur on the right hand side. But the only things on the right hand side are 0, 0, and tau. There's never a G on the right side. So any structure constant, no matter what we have down here, any structure constant with a Greek up there would have a G alpha on the right hand side. Nothing does. Zero, zero, epsilon, tau. So all structure constants of that form are zero. The only ones that aren't have to have a lowercase Latin index in each position, all three positions. Okay?
I think that makes sense, the explanation.
Next question.
On the left-hand side, on the first column, why did you, is that a Jacobian condition? Is that why you did that, or?
Where, here?
Yeah, what?
I'm just defining the dual one form. So, there's an inner product between forms and tangent vectors. Right? If I take a translation, let's see, what kinds of indices am I allowed to hear? All those erasers. Almost got out the door. On the group manifold, we've got a seven-dimensional group manifold from coordinates dx sigma.
Mm-hmm.
We have two vector spaces, space of forms, spaces, tangent vectors to curves, and those are dual to one another in the sense that you get a Kronecker when you take the inner product of them. There's an automatic invariant inner product there. This is a linear bracket, so the G's are linear combinations of the derivatives, the omegas are linear combinations of the DX's. So that's what told us before, that to find these, the coefficients of the DX's here are just the inverse matrices from the G's over there.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that?
Right.
So all I'm doing here is defining these one forms.
Oh, okay.
So these define the forms from the generators.
Okay, that makes sense.
And then the forms will satisfy, by the general proof we did, mm-hmm. will satisfy the Maurer-Cartan equation. And now we write the Cartan equation, warning the fact that I erased stuff before one could take a picture of it. And what we do is we add, let me say this in a fuller sentence. We change omega alpha and AI by adding horizontal curvature two forms satisfying the beyond gig entities. So we can immediately write these equations. We'll have some R alpha, and we'll have DAI is minus a half epsilon JKI, AJ, wedge AK, and now we're going to add Lie algebra values two forms. So the curvatures can be expanded in terms of these, of which form. What does horizontal mean? Yeah, independent of lifting. So which forms is R alpha independent of?
It's independent of the subgroups or by the subgroups.
So which forms do I or don't I put?
Okay.
I'm going to expand this in terms of some forms.
So it can't be in terms of the tau's, right? Everybody doing
the basic forms. It's independent of the A. So purely in terms of the Greek ones.
Right.
That's what. So the Greek ones span the base manifold.
Right. I'll look at that.
So the F are two forms on the base manifold. See you now.
See you. Yeah.
Like this. So that's the horizontal condition. The Bianchi identity, it gives us the vanishing covariant derivative in each case, which in the case of R is just a its exterior derivative vanishes. So R is just a curl of omega, an ordinary curl. So now let's okay. Question?
I didn't get the horizontal. I didn't see how you wrote either of those lines. Sorry.
Okay. Everything takes place on a seven-dimensional group manifold. So we have seven basis forms, the omegas and the a's. Mm-hmm. So on that full group manifold, an arbitrary one-form, say, b, could be expanded in terms of the omegas and in terms of the a. Right? So it's, you know, there are seven basis one forms on that whole group manifold. But we've divided the group manifold into a quotient where directions in the manifold are spanned by the omega alphas, and directions on the fibers are spanned by changing the AIs. If we change A, we move up and down the fiber. Those are copies of our SU2 subgroup. The translation group acts the other direction. So horizontal means we don't care how you move up and down. So we're going to drop terms like this and keep things only changing when we move in the horizontal direction. And so when I'm writing a two form, I expand it only in terms of the omegas and not in terms of the a's. So I could have cross terms with one omega and one a. I could have terms with two a's in general for a two form. But I don't have anything that's got A's in it. Otherwise, integrating these two forms over some surfaces would depend on how high up on the bundle I integrated it. Moving this way, I don't want it to depend on that. I only want things to depend on their projection onto M4.
Okay.
So, now we write an action. So we have our original action, but we need a covariant derivative. Okay, so make it covariant with respect to these transformations. Phi bar A, delta AB, covariant B flash, minus MAB, phi B, plus. Now, let's see, how do I want to do this? Let me write the killing metric. I can take the trace of the product of some g's, but those are all zero. But if I take the trace of the product of AI, AJ, or the corresponding generators, sorry, the generators are tau I, tau j. That's Kronecker IJ, give or take a factor. Let's see, what do these things look like? Minus I over 2. Trace, a product of polymatrices is a Kronecker. Then I have a minus 1/4, so the trace is going to be there will be a minus a half sitting there, which we don't really care about, but it happens to be there the way we've chosen the generators. So what I'm observing is that there is a natural metric on the SU2 subspace. In fact, SU2 preserves a Hermitian inner product. Right? You can take a sort of a dot product in that complex 2 space, a complex dot product, and that will be preserved by SU2 transformation. Yeah?
I have a question today.
Great question. Why, sorry.
In a general case,
yeah,
when we've got the exterior of exterior derivative of W equaling R A wedge with another R A, is that copy of D A 1? And that, like, if I mean, in a more general case, how would you know which horizontal to use? And how are you allowed to go?
Which horizontal?
I mean,
okay, we took a quotient. Right. Let's see, where did we do that? I may have erased that already. Did I take the quotient?
I don't think so. It's a structure constant for not zero for magma.
Right. Yeah, there would be other stuff there, yeah.
Yeah. And how do you decide which horizontal
They're still horizontal. You'd have some structure constants and some omegas and or a's out here.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. What we saw before is that this will always be involute.
Right.
Right. So there's always going to be at least one omega in everything. So we can always collapse back down to just the subgroup. So that subgroup is always there. These A's could feed back into the geometry,
mm-hmm.
right? They could affect the geometry. So that's okay. If there are some A's over here, well, it's just a complicated system we have to solve. So they could be there.
Okay.
Do we know what happens on these R's and S's?
It's conventional.
Okay.
Yeah, two forms, it's nice to have a half.
Okay.
For curvature, it's particularly handy. You save writing a lot of twos that way in the end. By the time you start solving, solve for those components, and putting a two here means that your solution for that won't have a half sitting in it somewhere or a factor of two or something. But it's just convention. Other questions?
Had you already taken quotient?
So, did I neglect to take the group quotient? Let's see, where should I have said that? Somewhere in here, let's say quotient. That gives us the fiber bundle. And it's that choice that tells us what's horizontal. So, now the omega alphas are horizontal. Okay, and then let's see. So I want to use this natural metric on at least the SU2 subgroup. So I could write a term that looks like a quarter with that delta ij, fi wedge dual of fj, and it gives me a way to contract those indices. I don't have such a thing for the horizontal stuff. I could invent a metric. I could say, well, suppose it's space-time and the metric is eta alpha beta, and introduce that by hand. And, you know, that's okay. That's done all the time. Let's see, is there any other thing that I could do with that? Let's leave it at that. We have a four-dimensional base manifold. Let's see, we can integrate that over M4. And now we find some field equations and solve. So vary everything in sight. What we're going to vary is psi A. We're going to vary the connection. Now, varying the omega alphas, you know, I didn't put in anything depending on R alpha. And that covariant derivative is really covariant with respect to the A's. Let's see. Could we even make it depend on the omega alphas? It's not clear that we could.
Is R alpha like a torsion in the last couple?
Yeah, it's exactly the torsion. And we're going to take it equal to zero.
Okay.
So let's not vary this, but set R alpha equal to zero. So now we have, this is going to give us field equations, right, vary psi bar, psi A, psi bar A, AI, but we'll just take this phase flat. So this is going to give us three equations for the A's. Each of these will give us equations for the components of the psi. So this variation gives us the D slash, I guess we'll keep the Kronecker here, minus MAB psi B equals zero, and we get the Hermitian conjugate. And notice this D contains the A. So now, if I bring the A term to the other side of this equation, those A's give away that these fields interact with one another. Okay. So, for example, if we look at just the electron, we'll have D slash of psi electron minus we'll arrange that to get the mass of the electron out times psi electron, and I bring the A part of this to the other side, what I have is AI tau I, and tau is an SU2 transformation. This actually acts on, this is going to mix in a little bit of the neutrino field. So, let's see, we'll have, let me think what it would be, we'll have A3 coupled to psi E, but we'll also have A, let's see, what's going to be 1 plus IA2 coupled to let me think what it is here. No, it's psi nu. Well, let's see. Is that or is that the conjugate? No, it's the minus. Yeah, we'll have something like that coupling to psi nu. So part of the source for the electron field is the neutrino field. They actually couple if A is non-trivial, all right? Well, what is A? A is a W boson or a Z naught particle. And the way that the electron and the neutrino interact with one another is by exchanging W and Z particles. So if there's been some exchange of those weak quanta, then the neutrino can affect the electron field. So now you see a non-trivial interaction between these particles as a result of the gauging. That's the force. That's where interactions come from.
How did you get from the line above that?
I did too much in my head. Let me write it out for you.
What's the big D flash?
Okay. Let me be explicit here. D flash of Phi B, alright, is we've got a derivative flash, that's a gamma matrix with a partial derivative, and then we have also got Lie algebra valued one form. Oh, I should have had an A flash in there anyway. It's more complicated than what I wrote. We have a gamma alpha. Remember, A is a one form, and it's Lie algebra valued. So I've got some generators of the group, what do they call them, tau. Each tau is actually a 2x2 matrix. Let's say BC by C, like that. So that's really what the covariant derivative of a weak multiplet is, right? There are two particles, and okay, you know, this is, you know, it acts on Psi B, you get Psi B back, but over here, these are proportional to the Pauli matrices. So it's going to mix a little of the second component of this into the first component and a little of the first into the second. So if I expand that out, you got it in one?
So which part? Just the taus are proportional to the Pauli matrices?
Yeah, remember that minus phi over 2 times the Pauli matrix. So if I write this out, for the first component here. So D slash of psi electron. I want the electron component of the Pauli matrices here, gamma alpha AI. Alright, so now the electron component here, if the Pauli matrix is sigma 3, that's diagonal. So that sigma 3 doesn't mix these things. So if I have a 3 alpha, then I'm going to get 5 electrons only. That's the top component. Right. Think of this as a Pauli matrix, you know, that's a 2x2 matrix that's got Psi E, Psi nu that it's acting on. So when this is diagonal, Psi E comes out, I'm looking at the D equal 1 component now. So then we have a term, gamma alpha. Now, when I is 1, so we have A1, this is proportional to sigma 1, which is off-diagonal and just pulls in a neutrino piece. I guess I should have the minus pi over 2 factor on all of these, too. Sorry about that. That's because sigma 1, remember, is 1, 1. So when I multiply sigma 1 by this, it picks up the psi nu. And then similarly for A2, it's going to pick up, sigma 2 is I minus I here. We're going to pick up a minus I psi nu. So it'll cancel that I. And we get phi 2, phi nu here. And then for the derivative of phi nu, here I have a tau 3, so it'll change to sine. Here I've got a 1 down here, so I get a phi e here with a 1. And here, I've got a plus I down there, so I'll have a plus a half A2 with Psi E here when I take the derivative of Psi E. You see it? I can fill in more gaps if you want.
That might be one that I should look at a little bit.
It's a good exercise, fill in the steps here.
Maybe we can start there and
after. Yeah. Okay.
Because there are a lot of steps in that one line.
Okay, so bring this up at the start of class on Wednesday. Try and fill in the steps on your own. But let's look at this. I'll fill out a little bit more of that argument on Wednesday.